Side 5, Count Zero, by William Gibson.
Continuing on page 147. Wish I'd got some. Every time Henry sees you dance, he won't let me alone. She laughed and refilled Bobby's cup from a black plastic thermos.
Well, Bobby said, when the girl was busy again with the espresso machine.
What next? Busy man, huh? Jackie regarded him coolly from beneath the gold-pinned hat brim. Got places you need to go? People to see? Well, no. Shit, I just mean, well, is this it? Is what it? This place. We're staying here? Top floor. Friend of mine named Jammer runs a club up there. Very unlikely anyone could find you there, and even if they do, it's a hard place to sneak up on. 14 floors of mostly stalls, and a whole lot of these people sell stuff they don't have out in plain view, right? So they're all very sensitive to strangers turning up, anyone asking questions. And most of them are friends of ours, one way or another. Anyway, you'll like it here. Good place for you. Lots to learn if you remember to keep your mouth shut. How am I going to learn if I don't ask questions? Well, I mean, keep your ears open, more like it. And be polite. Some tough people in here, but you mind your biz, they'll mind theirs. Beauvoir's probably coming by here late this afternoon. Lucas has gone out to the projects to tell them whatever you learned from the Finn. What did you learn from the Finn, hon? That he's got these 3 dead guys stretched out on his floor. Says they're ninjas. Bobby looked at her. He's pretty weird. Dead guys aren't part of his usual line of goods. But yeah, he's weird all right. Why don't you tell me about it, calmly and in low, measured tones? Think you can do that? Bobby told her what he could remember of his visit to the Finn. Several times she stopped him, asked questions he usually wasn't able to answer. She nodded when he first mentioned Wigan Ludgate. Yeah, she said. Jammer talks about him, when he gets going on the old days. Have to ask him. At the end of his recitation, she was lounging back against one of the green pillars, the hat very low over her dark eyes. Well, he asked. Interesting, she said, but that was all she'd say. I want some new clothes, Bobby said when they'd climbed the immobile escalator to the second floor. You got any money? She asked. Shit, he said, his hands in the pockets of the baggy pleated jeans. I don't have any fucking money, but I want some clothes. You and Lucas and Beauvoir are keeping my ass on ice for something, aren't you? Well, I'm tired of this god-awful shirt Rhea palmed off on me, and these pants always feel like they're about to fall off my ass. And I'm here because Tuaday, who's a low-life fuck, wanted to risk my butt so Lucas and Beauvoir could test their fucking software. So you can fucking well buy me some clothes, okay? Okay, she said after a pause. I'll tell you what. She pointed to where a Chinese girl in faded denim was furling the sheets of plastic that had fenced a dozen steel pipe garment racks hung with clothing. You see Lynn there. She's a friend of mine. You pick out what you want. I'll straighten it out between Lucas and her. Half an hour later, he emerged from a blanket-draped fitting room and put on a pair of Indo-Javanese mirrored aviator glasses. He grinned at Jackie. Real sharp, he said. Oh, yeah. She did a thing with her hand, a fanning movement, as though something nearby were too hot to touch. You didn't like that shirt Rhea loaned you? He looked down at the black T-shirt he'd chosen, at the square hollow decal of cyberspace on his chest. It was done so you seemed to be punching fast forward through the matrix, grid lines blurring at the edges of the decal. Yeah, it was too tacky. Right, Jackie said, taking in the tight black jeans, the heavy leather boots with spacesuit-style accordion folds at the ankle, the black leather garrison belt trimmed with twin lines of pyramidal chrome studs. Well, I guess you look more like the Count. Come on, Count, I got a couch for you to sleep on, up in Jammer's place. He leered at her, thumbs hooked in the front pockets of the black Levi's. Alone, she added. No fear. 20. Orly flight. Paco slung the Citroën Dornier down the Champ, along the north bank of the Seine, then up through Les Halles. Marley sank back into the astonishingly soft leather seat, more beautifully stitched than her Brussels jacket, and willed her mind to blankness, lack of affect. The eyes, she told herself, only eyes, your body a weight pressed evenly back by the speed of this obscenely expensive car. Humming past the Squale des Innocents, where whores dickered with the drivers of cargo hovers in bleu de travail, Paco steering effortlessly through the narrow streets. Why did you say, don't do this to me? He took his hand from the steering console and tapped his ear bead into position. Why were you listening? Because that is my job. I sent a woman up into the tower opposite his, to the 22nd floor, with a parabolic microphone. The phone in the apartment was dead, otherwise we could have used that. She went up, broke into a vacant unit on the west face of the tower, and aimed her microphone in time to hear you say, don't do this to me. And you were alone?
Yes.
He was dead?
Yes.
Why did you say it, then?
I don't know.
Who did you feel was doing something to you?
I don't know. Perhaps Alain.
Doing what?
Being dead, complicating matters, you tell me.
You are a difficult woman.
Let me out.
I will take you to your friend's apartment.
Stop the car.
I will take you to...
I'll walk.
The low silver car slid up to the curb. I will call you in the
good night.
You're certain you wouldn't prefer one of the spas? Asked Mr. Paleologus, thin and elegant as a mantis in his white hopsack jacket. His hair was white as well, brushed back from his forehead with extreme care. It would be less expensive and a great deal more fun. You're a very pretty girl.
Pardon?
Jerking her attention back from the street beyond the rain-streaked window.
A what?
His French was clumsy, enthusiastic, strangely inflected. A very pretty girl. He smiled primly. You wouldn't prefer a holiday in a med cluster, people your own age? Are you Jewish?
I beg your pardon?
Jewish. Are you?
No.
Too bad, he said. You have the cheekbones of a certain sort of elegant young Jewess. I've a lovely discount on 15 days to Jerusalem Prime, a marvelous environment for the price. Includes suit rental, 3 meals per diem, and direct shuttle from the JAL Taurus.
Suit rental?
They haven't entirely established atmosphere in Jerusalem Prime, Mr. Paleologus said, shuffling a stack of pink flimsies from one side of his desk to the other. His office was a tiny cubicle walled with hologram views of Poros and Macau. She'd chosen his agency for its evident obscurity, and because it had been possible to slip in without leaving the little commercial complex in the metro station nearest Andrea's. No, she said, I'm not interested in spas. I want to go here. She tapped the writing on the wrinkled blue wrapper from a pack of Gauloises. Well, he said, it's possible, of course, but I have no listing of accommodations. Will you be visiting friends?
A business trip, she said impatiently. I must leave immediately.
Very well, very well, Mr. Paleologus said, taking a cheap-looking lap terminal from a shelf behind his desk. Can you give me your credit code, please? She reached into her black leather bag and took out the thick bundle of new yen she'd removed from Paco's bag while he'd been busy examining the apartment where Alain had died. The money was fastened with a red band of translucent elastic.
I wish to pay cash.
Oh, dear, Mr. Paleologus said, extending a pink fingertip to touch the top bill, as though he expected the lot of it to vanish.
I see.
Well, you understand, I wouldn't ordinarily do business this way. But I suppose something can be arranged.
Quickly, she said. Very quickly. He looked at her. I understand. Can you tell me, please? His fingers began to move over the keys of the lap terminal. The name under which you wish to travel. 21. Highway time. Turner woke to the silent house, the sound of birds in the apple trees in the overgrown orchard. He slept on the broken couch Rudy kept in the kitchen. He drew water for coffee, the plastic pipes from the roof tank chugging as he filled the pot, put the pot on the propane burner, and walked out to the porch. Rudy's 8 vehicles were filmed with dew, arranged in a neat row on the gravel. One of the augmented hounds trotted through the open gate as Turner came down the steps, its black hood clicking softly in the morning quiet. It paused, drooling, swayed its distorted head from side to side, then scrambled across the gravel and out of sight, around the corner of the porch. Turner paused by the hood of a dull brown Suzuki Jeep, a hydrogen cell conversion. Rudy would have done the work himself. 4-wheel drive, big tires with off-road lugs crusted in pale dry river mud. Small, slow, reliable, not much use on the road. They passed 2 rust-flecked Honda sedans, identical, same year and model. Rudy would be ripping one for parts from the other. Neither would be running. He grinned absently at the immaculate brown and tan paintwork on the 1949 Chevrolet van, remembering the rusted shell Rudy had hauled home from Arkansas on a rented flatbed. The thing still ran on gasoline, the inner surfaces of its engine likely as spotless as the hand-rubbed chocolate lacquer of its fenders. There was half of a Dornier ground effect plane, under gray plastic tarps, and then a wasp-like black Suzuki racing bike on a homemade trailer. He wondered how long it had been since Rudy had done any serious racing. There was a snowmobile under another tarp, an old one, next to the bike trailer. And then the stained gray hovercraft, surplus from the war, a squat wedge of armored steel that smelled of the kerosene its turbine burned, its mesh-reinforced apron bag slack on the gravel. Its windows were narrow slits of thick high-impact plastic. There were Ohio plates bolted to the thing's ram-like bumpers. They were current. "I can see what you're thinking," Sally said, as he turned to see her at the porch rail with the pot of steaming coffee in her hand. "Rudy says if it can't get over something, it can anyway get through it." "Is it fast?" Touching the hover's armored flank. "Sure, but you'll need a new spine after about an hour." "How about the law?" "Can't much say they like the way it looks, but it's certified street legal. No law against armor that I know of." "Angie's feeling better," Sally said as he followed her in through the kitchen door. "Aren't you, honey?" Mitchell's daughter looked up from the kitchen table. Her bruising, like Turner's, had faded to a pair of fat commas, like painted blue-black tears. "My friend here's a doctor," Turner said. "He checked you out when you were under. He says you're doing okay."
"Your brother. He's not a doctor."
"Sorry, Turner," Sally said at the stove. "I'm pretty much straightforward." "Well, he's not a doctor," he said, "but he's smart. We were worried that Moss might have done something to you. Fixed it so you'd get sick if you left Arizona."
"Like a cortex bomb?"
She spooned cold cereal from a cracked bowl with apple blossoms around the rim, part of a set that Turner remembered.
"Lord," Sally said, "what have you gotten yourself into, Turner?"
"Good question." He took a seat at the table. Angie chewed her cereal, staring at him. "Angie," he said, "when Rudy scanned you, he found something in your head." She stopped chewing. "He didn't know what it was. Something someone put there, maybe when you were a lot younger. Do you know what I mean?" She nodded. "Do you know what it is?" She swallowed.
"No."
"But you know who put it there?"
"Yes."
"Your father?"
"Yes."
"Do you know why?"
"Because I was sick."
"How were you sick?"
I wasn't smart enough.
He was ready by noon, the hovercraft fueled and waiting by the chain-link gate. Rudy had given him a rectangular black Ziploc stuffed with new yen, some of the bills worn almost translucent with use.
"I tried that tape through a French lexicon," Rudy said, while one of the hounds rubbed its dusty ribs against his legs. "Doesn't work. I think it's some kind of Creole, maybe African. You want a copy?"
"No," Turner said. "You hang on to it."
"Thanks," Rudy said, "but no thanks. I don't plan on admitting you were ever here if anybody asks. Sally and I, we're heading into Memphis this afternoon. Stay with a couple of friends. Dogs will watch the house."
He scratched the animal behind its plastic hood.
"Right, boy?"
The dog whined and twitched.
"I had to train them off coon hunting when I put their infrareds in," he said. "There wouldn't have been any coons left in the county."
Sally and the girl came down the porch steps, Sally carrying a broken-down canvas carryall she'd filled with sandwiches and a thermos of coffee. Turner remembered her in the bed upstairs and smiled. She smiled back. She looked older today, tired. Angie had discarded the blood-stained Mass Neotech t-shirt in favor of a shapeless black sweatshirt Sally had found for her. It made her look even younger than she was. Sally had also managed to incorporate the remaining bruises into a baroque job of eye makeup that clashed weirdly with her kid's face and baggy shirt. Rudy handed Turner the key to the hovercraft.
"I had my old Cray cook me a précis of recent corporate news this morning. One thing you should probably know is that Mass Biolabs has announced the accidental death of Dr. Christopher Mitchell."
Impressive how vague those people can be.
"And you just keep the harness on real tight," Sally was saying, "or your ass'll be black and blue before you hit that Statesboro bypass."
Rudy glanced at the girl, then back at Turner. Turner could see the broken veins at the base of his brother's nose. His eyes were bloodshot, and there was a pronounced tick in his left eyelid.
"Well, I guess that's it.
Funny, but I'd come to figure I wouldn't see you again.
Kind of funny to see you back here."
"Well," Turner said, "you've both done more than I'd any right to expect."
Sally glanced away.
"So thanks. I guess we better go."
He climbed up into the cab of the hover, wanting to be gone. Sally squeezed the girl's wrist, gave her the carry-all, and stood beside her while she climbed up the two hinged footrests. Turner settled into the driver's seat.
"She kept asking for you," Rudy said. "After a while it got so bad, the endorphin analogs couldn't really cut the pain. And every 2 hours or so, she'd ask where you were, when you were coming."
"I sent you money," Turner said. "Enough to take her to Chiba. The clinics there could have tried something new."
Rudy snorted.
"Chiba? Jesus. She was an old woman. What the hell good would it have done, keeping her alive in Chiba for a few more months? What she mainly wanted was to see you."
"Didn't work out that way," Turner said as the girl got into the seat beside his and placed the bag on the floor between her feet.
"Be seeing you, Rudy."
He nodded. "Sally."
"So long," Sally said, her arm around Rudy.
"Who were you talking about?"
Angie asked as the hatch came down. Turner put the key in the ignition and fired up the turbine, simultaneously inflating the apron bag. Through the narrow window at his side, he saw Rudy and Sally back quickly away from the hover, the hound cowering and snapping at the noise of the turbine. The pedals and hand controls were oversized, designed to permit ease of operation for a driver wearing a radiation suit. Turner eased them out through the gates and swung around on a wide patch of gravel drive. Angie was buckling her harness. "My mother," he said.
He revved the turbine and they jolted forward.
"I never knew my mother," she said.
And Turner remembered that her father was dead and that she didn't know it yet. He hit the throttle and they shot off down the gravel drive, barely missing one of Rudy's hounds. Sally had been right about the thing's ride, There was constant vibration from the turbine. At 90 kilometers per hour on the skewed asphalt of the old state highway, it shook their teeth. The armored apron bag rode the broken surfaces heavily. The skim effect of a civilian sport model would only be possible on a perfectly smooth, flat surface. Turner found himself liking it, though. You pointed, eased back the throttle, and you went. Someone had hung a pair of pink, sun-faded foam dice above the forward vision slit, and the whine of the turbine was a solid thing behind him. The girl seemed to relax, taking in the roadside scenery with an absent, almost contented expression, and Turner was grateful that he wasn't required to make conversation. "You're hot," he thought, glancing sidelong at her. "You're probably the single most hotly pursued little item on the face of the planet today. And here I am hauling you off to the sprawl in Rudy's kid stuff war wagon. No fucking idea what I'm going to do with you now. Or who it was zapped the mall." "Run it through," he told himself, as they swung down into the valley. "Run it through again. Eventually something'll click." Mitchell had contacted Hosaka, said he was coming over. Hosaka hired Conroy and assembled a medical crew to check Mitchell for kinks. Conroy had put the teams together, working with Turner's agent. Turner's agent was a voice in Geneva, a telephone number. Hosaka had sent Allison in to vet him in Mexico, then Conroy had pulled him out. Weber, just before the shit hit the fan, had said that she was Conroy's plant at the site. Someone had jumped them as the girl was coming in, flares and automatic weapons. That felt like mass to him. It was the sort of move he'd expect, the sort of thing his hired muscle was there to deal with. Then the white sky. He thought about what Rudy had said about a railgun. Who? And the mess in the girl's head. The things Rudy had turned up on his tomograph and his NMR imager. She said her father had never planned on coming out himself. "No company," she said to the window. "How's that?" "You don't have a company, do you? I mean, you work for whoever hires you." "That's right." "Don't you get scared?" "Sure, but not because of that." "We've always had the company. My father said I'd be all right, that I was just going to another company." "You'll be fine. He was right. I just have to find out what's going on. Then I'll get you where you need to go."
"To Japan?"
"Wherever."
"Have you been there?"
"Sure."
"Would I like it?"
"Why not?" Then she lapsed into silence again, and Turner concentrated on the road. "It makes me dream," she said as he leaned forward to turn on the headlights, her voice barely audible above the turbine. "What does?" He pretended to be lost in his driving, careful not to glance her way. "The thing in my head. Usually it's only when I'm asleep."
"Yeah?"
Remembering the whites of her eyes in Rudy's bedroom, the shuddering, the rush of words in a language he didn't know.
"Sometimes when I'm awake, it's like I'm jacked into a deck, only I'm free of the grid, flying, and I'm not alone there. The other night I dreamed about a boy, and he'd reached out, picked up something, and it was hurting him, and he couldn't see that he was free, that he only needed to let go. So I told him. And for just a second, I could see where he was, and that wasn't like a dream at all. Just this ugly little room with a stained carpet. And I could tell he needed a shower and feel how the insides of his shoes were sticky because he wasn't wearing socks. That's not like the dreams."
"No?"
"No. The dreams are all big, big things. And I'm big, too, moving with the others."
Turner let his breath out as the hover whined up the concrete ramp to the interstate, suddenly aware that he'd been holding it.
"What others?"
"The bright ones."
Another silence.
"Not people."
"You spend much time in cyberspace, Angie? I mean, jacked in with a deck?"
"No, just school stuff. My father said it wasn't good for me,
He say anything about those dreams?
Only that they were getting realer. But I never told him about the others.
You want to tell me? Maybe it'll help me understand. Figure out what we need to do.
Some of them tell me things. Stories. Once there was nothing there. Nothing moving on its own. Just data and people shuffling it around. Then something happened, and it knew itself. There's a whole other story about that. A girl with mirrors over her eyes, and a man who was scared to care about anything. Something the man did helped the whole thing know itself. And after that, it sort of split off into different parts of itself. And I think the parts are the others, the bright ones. But it's hard to tell, because they don't tell it with words exactly.
Turner felt the skin on his neck prickle. Something coming back to him, up out of the drowned undertow of Mitchell's dossier. Hot burning shame in a hallway. Dirty cream paint peeling. Cambridge. The graduate dorm. Where were you born, Angie?
England. Then my father got into Mass. We moved. To Geneva.
Somewhere in Virginia, he eased the hovercraft over onto the gravel shoulder and out into an overgrown pasture, dust from the dry summer swirling out behind them as he swung them left and into a stand of pine. The turban died as they settled into the apron bag. "We might as well eat now," he said, reaching back for Sally's canvas carryall. Angie undid her harness and unzipped the black sweatshirt. Under it, she wore something tight and white, a child's smooth tanned flesh showing in the scooped neck above young breasts. She took the bag from him and began unwrapping the sandwiches Sally had made for him.
"What's wrong with your brother?" she asked, handing him half a sandwich.
"How do you mean?"
"Well, there's something."
"He drinks all the time," Sally said.
"Is he unhappy?"
"I don't know," Turner said, hunching and twisting the aches out of his neck and shoulders. "I mean, he must be, but I don't know exactly why. People get stuck sometimes."
"You mean when they don't have companies to take care of them?"
She bit into her sandwich. He looked at her. "Are you putting me on?" She nodded, her mouth full. Swallowed.
"A little bit. I know that a lot of people don't work for Mass. Never have and never will. You're one, your brother's another. But it was a real question. I kind of liked Rudy, you know. But he just seemed so...
screwed up," he finished for her, still holding his sandwich. "Stuck. What it is, I think there's a jump some people have to make sometimes. And if they don't do it, then they're stuck good. And Rudy never did it."
"Like my father wanting to get me out of Mass? Is that a jump?"
"No. Some jumps you have to decide on for yourself. Just figure there's something better waiting for you somewhere." He paused, feeling suddenly ridiculous, and bit into the sandwich.
"Is that what you thought?"
He nodded, wondering if it were true.
"So you left. And Rudy stayed."
"He was smart. Still is. And he'd rolled up a bunch of degrees, did it all on the line. Got a doctorate in biotechnology from Tulane when he was 20. A bunch of other stuff. Never sent out any resumes, nothing. We'd have recruiters turn up from all over, and he'd bullshit them, pick fights. I think he thought he could make something on his own. Like those hoods on the dogs. I think he's got a couple of original patents there, but... anyway, he stayed there. Got into dealings and doing hardware for people, and he was hot stuff in the county. And our mother got sick. She was sick for a long time. And I was away."
"Where were you?"
She opened the thermos, and the smell of coffee filled the cabin. "As far away as I could get," he said, startled by the anger in his voice. She passed him the plastic mug, filled to the brim with hot black coffee. How about you? You said you never knew your mother.
I didn't. They split when I was little. She wouldn't come back in on the contract unless he agreed to cut her in on some kind of stock plan. That's what he said, anyway.
So what's he like? He sipped coffee, then passed it back.
She looked at him over the rim of the red plastic mug, her eyes ringed with Sally's makeup. You tell me, she said, or else ask me in 20 years. I'm 17, how the hell am I supposed to know?
He laughed. You're starting to feel a little better now.
I guess so, considering the circumstances.
And suddenly he was aware of her, in a way he hadn't been before, and his hands went anxiously to the controls. Good. We still have a long way to go.
They slept in the hovercraft that night, parked behind the rusting steel lattice that had once supported a drive-in theater screen in southern Pennsylvania. Turner's parka spread on the armor plate floorboards below the turban's long bulge. She'd sipped the last of the coffee, cold now, as she sat in the square hatch opening above the passenger seat, watching the lightning bugs pulse across a field of yellowed grass. Somewhere in his dreams, still colored with random flashes from her father's dossier, she rolled against him, her breasts soft and warm against his bare back through the thin fabric of her t-shirt, and then her arm came over him to stroke the flat muscles of his stomach. But he lay still, pretending to a deeper sleep, and soon found his way down into the darker passages of Mitchell's Biosoft, where strange things came to mingle with his own oldest fears and hurts, and woke at dawn to hear her singing softly to herself from her perch in the roof hatch.
My daddy, he's a handsome devil, got a chain about 9 miles long, and from every link a heart does dangle, of another maid he's loved and wronged.
22. Jammers. Jammers was up 12 more flights of dead escalator and occupied the rear third of the top floor. Aside from Leon's place, Bobby had never seen a nightclub, and he found Jammers both impressive and scary. Impressive because of its scale and what he took to be the exceptional quality of the fittings, and scary because a nightclub by day is somehow innately unreal, witchy. He peered around, thumbs snagged in the back pockets of his new jeans, while Jackie conducted a whispered conversation with a long-faced white man in rumpled blue coveralls. The place was fitted out with dark ultra-suede banquettes, round black tables, and dozens of ornate screens of pierced wood. The ceiling was painted black, each table faintly illuminated by its own little recessed flood aimed straight down out of the dark. There was a central stage, brightly lit now, with work lights strung on yellow flecks, and in the middle of the stage a set of cherry-red acoustic drums. He wasn't sure why, but it gave him the creeps, some sidelong sense of a half-life, as though something was about to shift, just at the edge of his vision.
Bobby, Jackie said, come over here and meet Jammer.
He crossed the stretch of plain dark carpet with all the cool he could muster and faced the long-faced man, who had dark, thinning hair and wore a white evening shirt under his coveralls. The man's eyes were narrow, the hollows of his cheeks shadowed with a day's growth of beard. Well, the man said, you want to be a cowboy? He was looking at Bobby's t-shirt, and Bobby had the uncomfortable feeling that he might be about to laugh.
Jammer was a jockey, Jackie said. How does they come? Weren't you, Jammer?
So they say, Jammer said, still looking at Bobby. Long time ago, Jackie. How many hours you logged running? He asked Bobby. Bobby's face went hot.
Well, one, I guess.
Jammer raised his bushy eyebrows. Gotta start somewhere. He smiled, his teeth small and unnaturally even, and Bobby thought too numerous.
Bobby, Jackie said, why don't you ask Jammer about this wig character the Finn was telling you about?
Jammer glanced at her, then back to Bobby. You know the Finn? For a hot dogger, you're in pretty deep, aren't you? He took a blue plastic inhaler from his hip pocket and inserted it in his left nostril, snorted, then put it back in his pocket. Ludgate, the wig. Finn's talking about the wig? Must be in his dotage. Bobby didn't know what that meant, but it didn't seem like the time to ask. Well, Bobby ventured, this wig's up in orbit somewhere, and he sells the Finn stuff sometimes.
No shit?
Well, you could have fooled me. I would have told you the wig was either dead or drooling. Crazier than your usual cowboy, you know what I mean? Batshit. Gone. Haven't heard of him in years.
Jammer, Jackie said, I think it's maybe best if Bobby just tells you the story. Beauvoir's due here this afternoon, and he'll have some questions for you, so you better know where things stand.
Jammer looked at her. Well, I see. Mr. Beauvoir's calling in that favor, is he?
Can't speak for him, she said, but that would be my guess. We need a safe place to store the count here.
What count?
Me, Bobby said. That's me.
Great, Jammer said with a total lack of enthusiasm. So come on back into the office. Bobby couldn't keep his eyes off the cyberspace deck that took up a third of the surface of Jammer's antique oak desk. It was matte black, a custom job, no trademarks anywhere. He kept craning forward while he told Jammer about Two-A-Day and his attempted run, about the girl-feeling thing and his mother getting blown up. It was the hottest-looking deck he'd ever seen, and he remembered Jackie saying that Jammer had been such a shit-hot cowboy in his day. Jammer slumped back in his chair when Bobby was finished.
You want to try it? He asked. He sounded tired.
Try it?
The deck. I think you might want to try it. It's something about the way you keep rubbing your ass on the chair. Either you want to try it or you got to piss bad.
Shit, yeah. I mean, yeah, thanks. Yeah, I would.
Why not? No way for anybody to know it's you and not me, right? Why don't you jack in with him, Jackie? Kind of keep track.
He opened a desk drawer and took out two trode sets. But don't do anything, right? I mean, just buzz on out and spin. Don't try to run any numbers. I owe Beauvoir and Lucas a favor, and it looks like how I'm paying it back is by helping keep you intact. He handed one set of trodes to Jackie, the other to Bobby. He stood up, grabbed handles on either side of the black console, and spun it around so it faced Bobby. Go on. You'll cream your jeans. Thing's 10 years old, and it'll still wipe ass on most anything. Guy named of Automatic Jack built it straight up from scratch. He was Bobby Quine's hardware artist once. The two of them burnt the blue lights together, but that was probably before you were born. Bobby already had his trodes on. Now he looked at Jackie.
You ever jack tandem before?
He shook his head.
Okay, we'll jack, but I'll hang off your left shoulder. I say jack out, jack out. If you see anything funny, it'll be because I'm with you, understand?
He nodded. She undid a pair of long, silver-headed pins at the rear of her fedora and took it off, putting it down on the desk beside Jammer's deck. She slid the trodes on over the orange silk headscarf and smoothed the contacts against her forehead.
Let's go, she said.
Now and ever was, fast forward, Jammer's deck jacked up so high above the neon hot cores, a topography of data he didn't know. Big stuff. Mountain high, sharp and corporate in the non-place that was cyberspace.
Slow it down, Bobby.
Jackie's voice low and sweet beside him in the void.
Jesus Christ, this thing's slick. Yeah, but damp it down. The rush isn't any good for us. You want to cruise. Keep us up here and slow it down.
He eased off on forward until they seemed to coast along. He turned to the left, expecting to see her there, but there was nothing.
I'm here, she said. Don't worry.
Who was Quine?
Quine? Some cowboy Jammer knew. He knew them all in his day.
He took a right angle left at random, pivoting smoothly at the grid intersection, testing the deck for response. It was amazing, totally unlike anything he'd felt before in cyberspace.
Holy shit! This thing makes an Ono Sendai look like a kid's toy.
It's probably got OS circuitry in it. That's what they used to use, Jammer says. Takes us up a little more.
They rose effortlessly through the grid, the data receding below them.
There isn't a hell of a lot to see up here, he complained.
Wrong. You see some interesting stuff you hang out long enough in the blank parts. The fabric of the matrix seemed to shiver directly in front of them.
Jackie, stop here.
Hold it.
It's okay. Trust me.
Somewhere, far away, his hands moving over the unfamiliar keyboard configuration. He held them steady now, while a section of cyberspace blurred, grew milky.
What is... Danbala ab Montel, the voice said,
harsh in his head, and in his mouth a taste like blood.
Danbala is riding her.
He knew somehow what the words meant, but the voice was iron in his head. The milky fabric divided, seemed to bubble, became two patches of shifting gray.
Legba, she said.
Legba and Ugu Ferai, god of war.
Papa Ugu, Saint-Jacques-Major, vive la Vierge.
Iron laughter filled the matrix, sawing through Bobby's head.
M'apquitte tout misée à tout guillon,
said another voice, fluid and quicksilver and cold.
See, Papa, she has come here to throw away her bad luck.
And then that one laughed as well, and Bobby fought down a wave of sheer hysteria as the silver laughter rose through him like bubbles.
Has she bad luck, the horse of Danbala?
Boomed the iron voice of Ugu Ferai. And for an instant Bobby thought he saw a figure flicker in the gray fog. The voice hooted its terrible laughter.
Indeed, indeed, but she knows it not. She is not my horse, no, else I would cure her luck.
Bobby wanted to cry, to die, anything to escape the voices, the utterly impossible wind that had started to blow out of the gray warps, a hot, damp wind that smelled of things he couldn't identify.
And she calls praise on the Virgin. Hear me, little sister. La Vierge draws close indeed.
Yes, said the other. She moves through my province now. I who rule the roads, the highways.
But I, Ugu Ferai, tell you that your enemies draw near as well. To the gates, sister, and beware.
And then the gray areas faded, dwindled, shrank.
Jack us out, she said, her voice small and distant.
And then she said, Lucas is dead. Jammer took a bottle of scotch from his desk drawer and carefully poured 6 centimeters of the stuff into a plastic highball glass.
You look like shit, he said to Jackie.
And Bobby was startled by the gentleness in the man's voice. They'd been jacked out for at least 10 minutes, and nobody had said anything at all. Jackie looked crushed and kept gnawing at her lower lip. Jammer looked either unhappy or angry. Bobby wasn't sure.
How come you said Lucas was dead?
Bobby ventured, because it seemed to him that the silence was silting up in Jammer's cramped office like something that could choke you. Jackie looked at him but didn't seem to focus.
They wouldn't come to me like that if Lucas were alive, she said. There are pacts, agreements. Legba is always invoked first, but he should have come with Danbala. His personality depends on the lower he manifests with. Lucas must be dead.
Jammer pushed the glass of whiskey across the desk, but Jackie shook her head, the trode set still riding her forehead, chrome and black nylon. He made a disgusted face, pulled the glass back, and downed it himself. What a load of shit. Things made a lot more sense before you people started screwing around with them.
We didn't bring them here, Jammer, she said. They were just there, and they found us because we understood them.
Same load of shit, Jammer said wearily. Whatever they are, wherever they came from, they just shaped themselves to what a bunch of crazed spades wanted to see. You follow me? There's no way in hell there'd be anything out there that you had to talk to in fucking Bush Haitian. You and your voodoo cult. They just saw that, and they saw a setup, and Beauvoir and Lucas and the rest, They're businessmen first, and those goddamn things know how to make deals. It's a natural. He tightened the cap on his bottle and put it back in the drawer. You know, hon, it could just be that somebody very big, with a lot of muscle on the grid, they're just taking you for a ride, projecting those things, all that shit. And you know it's possible, don't you? Don't you, Jackie?
No way, Jackie said, her voice cold and even. But how I know that's not anything I can explain.
Jammer took a black slab of plastic from his pocket and began to shave. Sure, he said. The razor hummed as he worked on the line of his jaw. I lived in cyberspace for 8 years, right? Well, I know there wasn't anything out there. Not then. Anyway, you want me to phone Lucas? Set your mind at ease one way or the other? You got the phone number for that Rolls of his?
No,
Jackie said.
Don't bother.
Best we lay low till Beauvoir turns up. She stood, pulling off the trodes and picking up her hat.
I'm going to lie down. Try to sleep. You keep an eye on Bobby.
She turned and walked to the office door. She looked as though she were sleepwalking, all the energy gone out of her. Wonderful, Jammer said, running the shaver along his upper lip. You want a drink? He asked Bobby. Well, Bobby said, it's kind of early. For you, maybe. He put the razor back in his pocket. The door closed behind Jackie. Jammer leaned forward slightly. What did they look like, kid? You get a make?
Just kind of grayish. Fuzzy.
Jammer looked disappointed. He slouched back in his chair again. I don't think you can get a good look at him unless you're part of it. He drummed his fingers on the chair arm. You think they're for real?
Well, I wouldn't want to try messing one around.
Jammer looked at him. No? Well, maybe you're smarter than you look there. I wouldn't want to try messing one around myself. I got out of the game before they started turning up.
So what do you think they are?
Ah, still getting smarter. Well, I don't know. Like I said, I don't think I can swallow them being a bunch of Haitian voodoo gods, but who knows? He narrowed his eyes. Could be their virus programs that have gotten loose in the Matrix and replicated, and gotten really smart. That's scary enough. Maybe the Turing people want it kept quiet. Or maybe the AIs have found a way to split parts of themselves off into the Matrix, which would drive the Turings crazy. I knew this Tibetan guy did hardware mod for jockeys. He said they were tulpas. Bobby blinked. A tulpa's a thought form, kind of. Superstition. Really heavy people can split off a kind of ghost made of negative energy. He shrugged. More horseshit. Like Jackie's voodoo guys. Well, it looks to me like Lucas and Beauvoir and the others, they sure as hell play it like it was all real, and not just like it was an act. Jammer nodded. You got it. And they've been doing damn well for themselves by it, too, so there's something there. He shrugged and yawned. I gotta sleep, too. You can do whatever you want as long as you keep your hands off my deck. And don't try to go outside, or 10 kinds of alarms will start screaming. There's juice and cheese and shit in the fridge behind the bar. Bobby decided that the place was still scary, now that he had it to himself, but that it was interesting enough to make the scariness worthwhile. He wandered up and down behind the bar, touching the handles of the beer taps and the chrome drink nozzles. There was a machine that made ice, and another one that dispensed boiling water. He made himself a cup of Japanese instant coffee and sorted through Jammer's file of audio cassettes. He'd never heard of any of the bands or artists. He wondered whether that meant that Jammer, who was old, liked old stuff, or if this was all really new stuff that wouldn't filter out to Berrytown, probably by way of Leon's, for another 2 weeks. He found a gun under the black and silver Universal Credit console at the end of the bar, a kind of fat little machine gun with a magazine that stuck straight down out of the handle. It was stuck under the bar with a strip of lime green Velcro, and he didn't think it was a good idea to touch it. After a while, he didn't feel frightened anymore, just kind of bored and edgy. He took his cooling coffee and walked out into the middle of the seating area. He sat at one of the tables and pretended he was Count Zero, top console artist in the sprawl, waiting for some dudes to show and talk about a deal, some run they needed done, and nobody but the Count was even remotely up for it. "Sure," he said to the empty nightclub, his eyes hooded. "I'll cut it for you, if you got the money." They paled when he named his price. The place was soundproofed. He couldn't hear the bustle of the 14th floor's stalls at all, only the hum of some kind of air conditioner and the occasional gurgles of the hot water machine. Tired of the Count's power plays, Bobby left the coffee cup on the table and crossed to the entranceway, running his hand along an old stuffed velvet rope that was slung between polished brass poles. Careful not to touch the glass doors themselves, he settled himself on a cheap steel stool with a tape-patched leatherette top beside the coat check window. A dim bulb burned in the coat room. You could see a couple of dozen old wooden hangers dangling from steel rods, each one hung with a round yellow hand-numbered tag. He guessed Jammer sat here sometimes to check out the clientele. He didn't really see why anybody who'd been a shit-hot cowboy for 8 years would want to run a nightclub, but maybe it was sort of a hobby. He guessed you could get a lot of girls running a nightclub, but he'd assumed you could get a lot anyway if you were rich. And if Jammer had been a top jock for 8 years, Bobby figured he had to be rich. He thought about the scene in The Matrix, the gray patches and the voices. He shivered. He still didn't see why it meant Lucas was dead. How could Lucas be dead? Then he remembered that his mother was dead, and somehow that didn't seem too real either. Jesus, it all got on his nerves. He wished he were outside, on the other side of the doors, checking out the stalls and the shoppers and the people who worked there. He reached out and drew the velour curtain aside, just wide enough to peer out through the thick old glass, taking in the rainbow jumble of stalls and the characteristic grazing gait of the shoppers. And framed for him, square in the middle of it all, beside a table jammed with surplus analog VOMs, logic probes, and power conditioners, was the raceless, bone-heavy face of Leon, and the deep-set, hideous eyes seemed to look into Bobby's with an audible click of recognition. And then Leon did something Bobby couldn't remember ever having seen him do. He smiled. 23. Closer. The J.A.L. steward offered her a choice of SimStim cassettes, a tour of the Foxton retrospective at the Tate the previous August, a period adventure taped in Ghana, Ashanti, highlights from Bizet's Carmen as viewed from a private box at the Tokyo Opera, or 30 minutes of Tally Isham's syndicated talk show Top People. "Your first shuttle flight, Nizovsky?" Marley nodded. She'd given Paleologus her mother's maiden name, which had probably been stupid. The steward smiled understandingly. "A cassette can definitely ease the lift off. The Carmen's very popular this week. Gorgeous costumes, I understand." She shook her head, in no mood for opera. She loathed Foxton, and would have preferred to feel the full force of acceleration rather than live through Ashanti. She took the Isham tape by default as the least of four evils. The steward checked her seat harness, handed her the cassette and a little throwaway tiara in gray plastic, then moved on. She put the plastic trode set on, jacked it into the seat arm, sighed, and slotted the cassette in the opening beside the jack. The interior of the J.A.L. shuttle vanished in a burst of Aegean blue, and she watched the words, "Tally Isham's Top People," expand across the cloudless sky and elegant sans-serif capitals. Tally Isham had been a constant in the stim industry for as long as Marley remembered, an ageless golden girl who'd come in on the first wave of the new medium. Now Marley found herself locked into Tally's tanned, live, tremendously comfortable sensorium. Tally Isham glowed, breathed deeply and easily, her elegant bones riding in the embrace of a musculature that seemed never to have known tension.
Accessing her stim recordings was like falling into a bath of perfect health, feeling the spring in the star's high arches and the jut of her breasts against the silky white Egyptian cotton of her simple blouse. She was leaning against a pocked white balustrade above the tiny harbor of a Greek island town, a cascade of flowering trees falling away below her down a hillside built from whitewashed stone and narrow, twisting stairs. A boat sounded in the harbor. "The tourists are hurrying back to their cruise ship now," Tally said, and smiled. When she smiled, Marley could feel the smoothness of the star's white teeth, taste the freshness of her mouth, and the stone of the balustrade was pleasantly rough against her bare forearms. "But one visitor to our island will be staying with us this afternoon, someone I've longed to meet, and I'm sure that you'll be delighted and surprised, as he's someone who ordinarily shuns major media coverage." She straightened, turned, and smiled into the tanned, smiling face of Josef Virek. Marley tore the set from her forehead, and the white plastic of the JAL shuttle seemed to slam into place all around her. Warning signs were blinking on the console overhead, and she could feel a vibration that seemed to gradually rise in pitch. "Virek." She looked at the trode set. "Well," she said, "I suppose you are a top person." "I beg your pardon?" The Japanese student beside her bobbed in his harness in a strange little approximation of a bow. "You are in some difficulty with your stim?"
"No,
no," she said. "Excuse me." She slid the set on again, and the interior of the shuttle dissolved in a buzz of sensory static, a jarring melange of sensations that abruptly gave way to the calm grace of Tally Isham, who had taken Virek's cool, firm hand and was smiling into his soft blue eyes. Virek smiled back, his teeth very white. "Delighted to be here, Tally," he said. And Marley let herself sink into the reality of the tape, accepting Tally's recorded sensory input as her own. Stim was a medium she ordinarily avoided, something in her personality conflicting with the required degree of passivity. Virek wore a soft white shirt, cotton duck trousers rolled to just below the knee, and very plain brown leather sandals. His hand still in hers, Tally returned to the balustrade. "I'm sure," she said, "that there are many things our audience..." The sea was gone. An irregular plain covered in a green-black growth like lichen spread out to the horizon, broken by the silhouettes of the neo-Gothic spires of Gaudí's Church of the Sagrada Familia. The edge of the world was lost in a low bright mist, and a sound like drowned bells tolled in across the plain. "You have an audience of one today," Virek said, and looked at Tally Isham through his round, rimless glasses. "Hello, Marley." Marley struggled to reach the trodes, but her arms were made of stone. G-force, the shuttle lifting off from its concrete pad. He'd trapped her here. "I understand," said Tally, smiling, leaning back against the balustrade, her elbows on warm, rough stone. "What a lovely idea. Your Marley, Herr Virek, must be a lucky girl indeed." And it came to her, to Marley, that this wasn't SenseNet's Tally Isham, but a part of Virek's construct, a programmed point of view worked up from years of top people, and that now there was no choice, no way out, except to accept it, to listen, to give Virek her attention. The fact of his having caught her here, pinned her here this way, told her that her intuition had been correct. The machine, the structure, was there, was real. Virek's money was a sort of universal solvent, dissolving barriers to his will. "I'm sorry," he said, "to learn that you are upset. Paco tells me that you are fleeing from us, but I prefer to see it as the drive of an artist toward her goal. You have sensed, I think, something of the nature of my gestalt, and it has frightened you, as well it should. This cassette was prepared an hour before your shuttle was scheduled to lift off from Orly. We know your destination, of course, but I have no intention of following you. You are doing your job, Marley. I only regret that we were unable to prevent the death of your friend Ardan, but we now know the identity of his killers and their employers." Tally Isham's eyes were Marley's eyes now,
and they were locked with Virix, a blue energy burning there. Alain was murdered by the hired agents of Mas Biolabs, he continued, and it was Mas who provided him with the coordinates of your current destination. Mas who gave him the hologram you saw. My relationship with Mas Biolabs has been ambivalent, to say the least. 2 years ago, a subsidiary of mine attempted to buy them out. The sum involved would have affected the entire global economy. They refused. Paco has determined that Alain died because they discovered that he was attempting to market the information they had provided, market it to third parties. He frowned. Exceedingly foolish, because he was utterly ignorant of the nature of the product he was offering. How like Alain, she thought, and felt a wave of pity. Seeing him curled there on the hideous carpet, his spine outlined beneath the green fabric of his jacket. You should know, I think, that my search for our boxmaker involves more than art, Marley. He removed his glasses and polished them in a fold of his white shirt. She found something obscene in the calculated humanity of the gesture. I have reason to believe that the maker of these artifacts is in some position to offer me freedom, Marley. I am not a well man. He replaced the glasses, settling the fine gold earpieces carefully. When I last requested a remote visual of the vat I inhabit in Stockholm, I was shown a thing like 3 truck trailers, lashed in a dripping net of support lines. If I were able to leave that, Marley, or rather, to leave the riot of cells it contained. Well, he smiled his famous smile again. What wouldn't I pay? And Tally Marley's eyes swung to take in the expanse of dark lichen and the distant towers of the misplaced cathedral. You lost consciousness, the steward was saying, his fingers moving across her neck. It isn't uncommon, and our onboard medical computers tell us you're in excellent health. However, we've applied a dermadisc to counteract the adaptation syndrome you might experience prior to docking. His hand left her neck. Europe after the rains, she said. Max Ernst, the lichen. The man stared down at her, his face alert now and expressing professional concern. Excuse me, could you repeat that? I'm sorry, she said. A dream. Are we there yet, at the terminal? Another hour, he said. Japan Air's orbital terminus was a white toroid studded with domes and ringed with the dark-rimmed oval openings of docking bays. The terminal above Marley's G-web, though above had temporarily lost its usual meaning, displayed an exquisitely drafted animation of the torus in rotation, while a series of voices, in 7 languages, announced that the passengers on board JAL's Shuttle 580, Orly Terminus 1, would be taxied to the terminal at the earliest opportunity. JAL offered apologies for the delay, which was due to routine repairs underway in 7 of the 12 bays. Marley cringed in her G-web, seeing the invisible hand of Virek in everything now. No, she thought, there must be a way. I want out of it, she told herself. I want a few hours as a free agent, and then I'll be done with him. Goodbye, Herr Virek. I return to the land of the living, as poor Alain never will. Alain, who died because I took your job. She blinked her eyes when the first tear came, then stared wide-eyed as a child at the minute floating spherelet the tear had become. And Mas, she wondered, who were they? Virek claimed that they had murdered Alain, that Alain had been working for them. She had vague recollections of stories in the media, something to do with the newest generation of computers, some ominous-sounding process in which immortal hybrid cancers spewed out tailored molecules that became units of circuitry. She remembered now that Paco had said that the screen of his molecular telephone was a mass product. The interior of the JAL toroid was so bland, so unremarkable, so utterly like any crowded airport, that she felt like laughing.
There was the same scent of perfume, human tension, and heavily conditioned air, and the same background hum of conversation. The 0.8 gravity would have made it easier to carry a suitcase, but she only had her black purse. Now she took her tickets from one of its zippered inner pockets and checked the number of her connecting shuttle against the columns of numbers arrayed on the nearest wall screen. 2 hours to departure. Whatever Virek might say, she was sure that his machine was already busy, infiltrating the shuttle's crew or roster of passengers, the substitutions lubricated by a film of money. There would be last-minute illnesses, changes in plan, accidents. Slinging the purse over her shoulder, she marched off across the concave floor of white ceramic as though she actually knew where she was going, or had some sort of plan, but knowing with each step she took that she didn't. Those soft blue eyes haunted her. "Damn you," she said, and a jowly Russian businessman in a dark Ginza suit sniffed and raised his newsfax, blocking her out of his world. "So I told the bitch, see, you gotta get those opto-isolators and the breakout boxes out to Sweet Jane, or I'll glue your ass to the bulkhead with gasket paste." Raucous female laughter, and Marley glanced up from her sushi tray. The three women sat 2 empty tables away, their own table thick with beer cans and stacks of styrofoam trays smeared with brown soy sauce. One of them belched loudly and took a long pull at her beer. "So how'd she take it, Rez?" This was somehow the cue for another longer burst of laughter, and the woman who'd first attracted Marley's attention put her head down in her arms and laughed until her shoulders shook. Marley stared dully at the trio, wondering what they were. Now the laughter had subsided, and the first woman sat up, wiping tears from her eyes. They were all quite drunk, Marley decided, young and loud and rough-looking. The first woman was slight and sharp-faced, with wide gray eyes above a thin, straight nose. Her hair was some impossible shade of silver, clipped short like a schoolboy's, and she wore an oversized canvas vest or sleeveless jacket covered entirely in bulging pockets, studs, and rectangular strips of Velcro. The garment hung open, revealing, from Marley's angle, a small round breast sheathed in what seemed to be a bra of fine pink and black mesh. The other two were older and heavier, the muscles of their bare arms defined sharply in the seemingly sourceless light of the terminal cafeteria. The first woman shrugged, her shoulders moving inside the big vest. "Not that she'll do it," she said. The second woman laughed again, but not as heartily, and consulted a chronometer riveted on a wide leather wristband. "Me for off," she said. "Got a Zion run, then 8 pods of algae for the Swedes." Then shoved her chair back from the table, stood up, and Marley read the embroidered patch centered across the shoulders of her black leather vest. "O'Grady Wajima, the Edith S., interorbital hauling." Now the woman beside her stood, hitching up the waistband of her baggy jeans. "I tell you, Rez, you let that cunt short you on those breakouts, it'll be bad for your name." "Excuse me," Marley said, fighting the quaver in her voice. The woman in the black vest turned and stared at her. "Yeah?" The woman looked her up and down, unsmiling. "I saw your vest, the name Edith S. That's a ship, a spaceship." "A spaceship?" The woman beside her raised thick eyebrows. "Oh, yeah, honey, a whole mighty spaceship." "She's a tug," the woman in the black vest said, and turned to go. "I want to hire you," Marley said. "Hire me?" Now they were all staring at her, faces blank and unsmiling. "What's that mean?" Marley fumbled deep in the black Brussels purse and came up with the half-sheaf of new yen that Paleologus, the travel agent, had returned after taking his fee. "I'll give you this." The girl with the short silver hair whistled softly. The women glanced at one another. The one in the black vest shrugged. "Jesus," she said. "Where you want to go? Mars?" Marley dug into her purse again and produced the folded blue paper from a pack of Gauloises. She handed it to the woman in the black vest, who unfolded it and read the orbital coordinates that Alain had written there in green felt pen. "Well," the woman said, "it's a quick enough hop for that kind of money.
that O'Grady and I were due in Zion, 2300 GMT. Contract job. What about you, Rez? She handed the paper to the seated girl, who read it, looked up at Marley, and asked, When? Now, Marley said. Right now. The girl pushed up from the table, the legs of her chair clattering on the ceramic, her vest swinging open to reveal that what Marley had taken for the net of a pink and black bra was a single tattooed rose that entirely covered her left breast. You're on, sister. Cash up. Means give her the money now, O'Grady said. I don't want anyone to know where we're going, Marley said. The three women laughed. You come to the right girl, O'Grady said. And Rez grinned. 24. Run straight down. The rain came on when he turned east again, making for the sprawl's fringe burbs and the blasted belt country of the industrial zones. It came down in a solid wall, blinding him until he found the switch for the wipers. Rudy hadn't kept the blades in shape, so he slowed, the turbine's whine lowering to a roar, and edged over the shoulder, the apron bag nosing past shredded husks of truck tires. What's wrong? I can't see. The wiper blades are rotten. He tapped the button for the lights, and four tight beams stabbed out from either side of the hover's wedge of hood and lost themselves in the gray wall of the downpour. He shook his head. Why don't we stop? We're too close to the sprawl. They patrol all this. Copters. They'd scan the ID panel on the roof and see we've got Ohio plates and a weird chassis configuration. They might want to check us out. We don't want that. What are you going to do? Keep to the shoulder until I can turn off, then get us under some cover if I can. He held the hover steady and swung it around in place, the headlights flashing off the day-glow orange diagonals on an upright pole marking a service road. He made for the pole, the bulging lip of the apron bag bobbling over a thick rectangular crash guard of concrete. This might do it, he said as they slid past the pole. The service road was barely wide enough for them. Branches and undergrowth scratched against the narrow side windows, scraping along the hover's steel plate flanks. Light down there, Angie said, straining forward in her harness to peer through the rain. Turner made out a watery yellow glow and twin dark uprights. He laughed. Gas station, he said. Left over from the old system, before they put the big road through. Somebody must live there. Too bad we don't run on gasoline. He eased the hover down the gravel slope. As he drew nearer, he saw that the yellow glow came from a pair of rectangular windows. He thought he saw a figure move in one of them. Country, he said. These boys may not be too happy to see us. He reached into the parka and slid the Smith & Wesson from its nylon holster, put it on the seat between his thighs. When they were 5 meters from the rusting gas pumps, he sapped the hover down in a broad puddle and filled the turbines. The rain was still pissing down in wind-blown sheets, and he saw a figure in a flapping khaki poncho duck out of the front door of the station. He slid the side window open 10 centimeters and raised his voice above the rain. Sorry to bother you. We had to get off the road. Our wipers are trashed. Didn't know you were down here. The man's hands, in the glow of the windows, were hidden beneath the plastic poncho, but it was obvious that he held something. Private property, the man said, his lean face streaked with rain. Couldn't stay on the road, Turner called. Sorry to bother you. The man opened his mouth, began to gesture with the thing he held beneath the poncho, and his head exploded. It almost seemed to Turner that it happened before the red line of light scythed down and touched him, pencil-thick beam swinging casually, as though someone were playing with a flashlight. A blossom of red, beaten down by the rain, as the figure went to its knees and tumbled forward. A wire-stocked Savage 410 sliding from beneath the poncho. Turner hadn't been aware of moving, but he found that he'd stoked the turbines, swung the controls over to Angie, and clawed his way out of his harness. I say go, run it through the station. Then he was up, yanking at the lever that opened the roof hatch, the heavy revolver in his hand. The roar of the black Honda reached him as soon as the hatch slid back, a lowering shadow overhead, just visible through the driving rain. Now! He pulled the trigger before she could kick them forward and through the wall of the old station,
the recoil jarring his elbow numb against the roof of the hover. The bullet exploded somewhere overhead with a gratifying crack. Angie floored the hover, and they plunged through the wood frame structure, with barely enough time for Turner to get his head and shoulders back down through the hatch. Something in the house exploded, probably a propane canister, and the hover skewed to the left. Angie swung them back around as they crashed out through the far wall. "Where?" she yelled above the turbine. As if in answer, the black Honda came corkscrewing down, 20 meters in front of them, and threw up a silver sheet of rain. Turner grabbed the controls and they slid forward, the hover blasting up 10-meter fantails of groundwater. They took the little combat copter square in its polycarbon canopy, its alloy fuselage crumpling like paper under the impact. Turner backed off and went in again, faster. This time the broken copter slammed into the trunks of 2 wet gray pines, lay there like some kind of long-winged fly.
"What happened?" Angie said, her hands to her face. "What happened?"
Turner tore registration papers and dusty sunglasses from a compartment in the door beside him, found a flashlight, checked its batteries.
"What happened?" Angie said again, like a recording. "What happened?"
He scrambled back up through the hatch, the gun in one hand, the light in the other. The rain had slackened. He jumped down onto the hover's hood, and then over the bumpers and into ankle-deep puddles, splashing toward the bent black rotors of the Honda. There was a reek of escaping jet fuel. The polycarbon canopy had cracked like an egg. He aimed the Smith & Wesson and thumbed the xenon flash twice, 2 silent pops of merciless light showing him blood and twisted limbs through the shattered plastic. He waited, then used the flashlight. 2 of them. He came closer, holding the flashlight well away from his body, an old habit. Nothing moved. The smell of escaping fuel grew even stronger. Then he was tugging at the bent hatch. It opened. They both wore image-amp goggles. The round, blank eye of the laser stared straight up into the night, and he reached down to touch the matted sheepskin collar of the dead man's bomber jacket. The blood that covered the man's beard looked very dark, almost black in the flashlight's beam. It was Oki. He swung the beam left and saw that the other man, the pilot, was Japanese. He swung the beam back and found a flat black flask beside Oki's foot. He picked it up, stuffed it into one of the parka's pockets, and dashed back to the hover. In spite of the rain, orange flames were starting to lick up through the wreckage of the gas station. He scrambled up the hover's bumper, across the hood, up again, and down through the hatch.
"What happened?" Angie said, as though he hadn't left. "What happened?"
He fell into his seat, not bothering with the harness, and revved the turbine. "That's a Hosaka helicopter," he said, swinging them around. "They must have been following us. They had a laser. They waited until we were off the highway. Didn't want to leave us out there for the cops to find. When we pulled in here, they decided to go for us, but they must have figured that that poor fucker was with us. Or maybe they were just taking out a witness."
"His head," she said, her voice shaking. "His head."
"That was the laser," Turner said, steering back up the service road. The rain was thinning, nearly gone. "Steam. The brain vaporizes and the skull blows." Angie doubled over and threw up. Turner steered with one hand, Oki's flask in the other. He pried the snap-fit lid open with his teeth and gulped back a mouthful of Oki's wild turkey. As they reached the shoulder of the highway, the Honda's fuel found the flames of the ruined station, and the twisted fireball showed Turner the mall again, the light of the parachute flares, the sky whiting out as the jet streaked for the Sonora border. Angie straightened up, wiped her mouth with the back of her hand, and began to shake. "We've got to get out of here," he said, driving east again. She said nothing, and he glanced sideways to see her rigid and upright in her seat, her eyes showing white in the faint glow of the instrument, her face blank. He'd seen her that way in Rudy's bedroom, when Sally had called them in. And now that same flood of language, a soft, fast rattle of something that might have been patois French. He had no recorder, no time. He had to drive. "Hang on," he said as they accelerated. "You'll be okay." Sure, she couldn't hear him at all. Her teeth were chattering. He could hear it above the turbine. Stock, he thought, long enough to get something between her teeth. His wallet or a fold of cloth,
Her hands were plucking spastically at the straps of the harness.
There is a sick child in my house.
The hover nearly left the pavement when he heard the voice come from her mouth, deep and slow and weirdly glutinous.
I hear the dice being tossed for her bloody dress. Many are the hands who dig her grave tonight, and yours as well. Enemies pray for your death, hired man. They pray until they sweat. Their prayers are a river of fever. And then a sort of croaking that might have been laughter.
Turner risked a glance, saw a silver thread of drool descend from her rigid lips. The deep muscles of her face had contorted into a mask he didn't know.
Who are you?
I am the Lord of Rhodes.
What do you want?
This child for my horse, that she may move among the towns of men. It is well that you drive east. Carry her to your city. I shall ride her again. And Samdi rides with you, gunman. He is the wind you hold in your hands, but he is fickle, the Lord of Graveyards, no matter that you have served him well.
He turned in time to see her slump sideways in the harness, her head lolling, mouth slack. 25. Casual, Gothic.
This is the Finn's phone program, said the speaker below the screen. And the Finn, he's not here. You want to download, you know the access code already. You want to leave a message, leave it already.
Bobby stared at the image on the screen and slowly shook his head. Most phone programs were equipped with cosmetic video subprograms written to bring the video image of the owner into greater accordance with the more widespread paradigms of personal beauty, erasing blemishes and subtly molding facial outlines to meet idealized statistical norms. The effect of a cosmetic program on the Finn's grotesque features was definitely the weirdest thing Bobby had ever seen, as though somebody had gone after the face of a dead gopher with a full range of mortician's crayons and paraffin injection.
That's not natural, said Jammer, sipping scotch.
Bobby nodded.
Finn, Jammer said, is agoraphobic. Gives him the hives to leave that impacted shit pile of a shop. And he's a phone junkie. Can't not answer a call if he's there.
I'm starting to think the bitch is right. Lucas is dead, and some heavy shit is going down.
The bitch, Jackie said from behind the bar, knows already.
She knows, Jammer said, putting the plastic glass down and fingering his bolo tie. She knows. Talk to a hoodoo in the Matrix, so she knows.
Well, Lucas isn't answering, and Beauvoir isn't answering, so maybe she's right.
Bobby reached out and shut off the phone as the record tone began to squeal.
Jammer was gotten up in a pleated shirt, white dinner jacket, and black trousers with satin stripes down the leg, and Bobby took this to be his working outfit for the club.
Nobody's here, he said now, looking from Bobby to Jackie. Where's Bogue and Sharky? Where is the waitresses?
Who's Bogue and Sharky? Bobby asked.
The bartenders. I don't like this.
He got up from his chair, walked to the door, and gently edged one of the curtains aside.
What the fuck are those dipshits doing out there? Hey, Count, this looks like your speed. Get over here.
Bobby got up, full of misgivings. He hadn't felt like telling Jackie or Jammer about letting Leon see him, because he didn't want to look like a Wilson, and walked over to where the club owner stood.
Go on, take a peek. Don't let him see you. They're pretending so hard not to watch us, you can almost smell it.
Bobby moved the curtain, careful to keep the crack no more than a centimeter wide, and looked out. The shopping crowd seemed to have been replaced almost entirely by black-crested gothic boys in leather and studs, and, amazingly, by an equal proportion of blonde casuals, the latter decked out in the week's current Shinjuku cottons and gold-buckled white loafers.
I don't know, Bobby said, looking up at Jammer, but they shouldn't be together, casuals and gothics, you know. They're like natural enemies. It's in the DNA or something. He took another look.
God damn, there's about 100 of them.
Jammer stuck his hands deep in his pleated trousers. You know any of those guys personally?
Gothics, I know some of them to talk to. Except it's hard to tell them apart. Casuals, they'll stomp anything that isn't casual. That's mainly what they're about. But I've just been cut up by Loebs anyway, and Loebs are supposed to be under treaty with the Gothics, so who knows?
Jammer sighed. So, I guess you don't feel like strolling out there and asking one what they think they're up to.
No, Bobby said earnestly. I don't.
Jammer looked at Bobby in a calculating way, a way that Bobby definitely didn't like. Something small and hard dropped from the high black ceiling and clicked loudly on one of the round black tables. The thing bounced and hit the carpet, rolling, and landed between the toes of Bobby's new boots. Automatically he bent and picked it up, an old-fashioned slot-headed machine screw, its threads brown with rust and its head clotted with dull black latex paint. He looked up as the second one struck the table and caught a glimpse of an unnervingly agile Jammer vaulting the bar beside the Universal Credit Unit. Jammer vanished. There was a faint ripping sound, Velcro, and Bobby knew that Jammer had the squat little automatic weapon he'd seen there earlier in the day. He looked around, but Jackie was nowhere in sight. A third screw ticked explosively on the formica of the tabletop. Bobby hesitated, confused, but then followed Jackie's example and got out of sight, moving as quietly as he could. He crouched behind one of the club's wooden screens and watched as the fourth screw came down, followed by a slender cascade of fine dark dust. There was a scraping sound, and then a square steel ceiling grate vanished abruptly, withdrawn into some kind of duct. He glanced quickly to the bar, in time to see the fat recoil compensator on the barrel of Jammer's gun as it swung up. A pair of thin brown legs dangled from the opening now, and a gray shark-skin hem smudged with dust.
Hold it, Bobby said. It's Beauvoir.
You bet it's Beauvoir, came the voice from above, big and hollow with the echo of the duct. Get that damn table out of the way. Bobby scrambled out from behind the screen and hauled the table and chairs to the side. Catch this, Beauvoir said, and dangled a bulging olive-drab pack from one of its shoulder straps, then let it go. The weight of the thing nearly took Bobby to the floor. Now get out of my way! Beauvoir swung down out of the duct, hung from the opening's edge with both hands, then dropped. What happened to the screamer I had up there? Jammer asked, standing up behind the bar, the little machine gun in his hands. Right here, Beauvoir said, tossing a dull gray bar of phenolic resin to the carpet. It was wrapped with a length of fine black wire. No other way I could get in here without a regular army of shitballs knowing about it, as it happens. Somebody's obviously given them the blueprints to the place, but they've missed that one.
How'd you get up to the roof? Jackie asked, stepping from behind a screen.
I didn't, Beauvoir said, pushing his big plastic frames back up his nose. I shot a line of monomol across from the stack next door, then slid over on a ceramic spindle. His short, nappy hair was full of furnace dust. He looked at her gravely. You know, he said.
Yes. Begba and Papa Ugu in the Matrix. I jacked with Bobby on Jammer's deck.
They blew Ahmed away on the Jersey Freeway. Probably used the same launcher they did Bobby's old lady with.
Who?
Still not sure, Beauvoir said, kneeling beside the pack and clicking open the quick-release plastic fasteners. But it's starting to shape up. End of side 5. To continue, turn the cassette over.